Welcome to Heart of Iowa on KHOY Community Radio, a program offering a patchwork quilt of ideas and people of note in Central Iowa.
When we're out in the woods and I see how the children traverse and use their bodies, to me that is all academic readiness, because all their neurological systems are getting healthfully integrated into a whole being that can, you just get out of their way because they're going to be ready to take on the world.
That's Delphine Douglas, sharing her observations after teaching for more than 12 years at the Ames Waldorf Preschool, known as Prairie Flower Children's Center. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and my interview with Delphine and her co-teacher will be featured in the second half of the show. Today's topic is kids and their outdoor play. What outdoor play, you might ask? Many kids don't really play outdoors that much anymore. In fact, that phenomenon has become a diagnosis: nature deficit disorder. Our guest today will share what kids are missing by not playing outdoors and give strategies for re-engaging them with nature. First up is Pamela Riney-Kerberg, a historian at ISU who is writing a book tentatively titled The Nature of Childhood. Her work describes how childhood has changed in America from the post-Civil War period to the present. Here's Dr. Kerberg.
In the period immediately following the Civil War, most American children were farm children, and they had a very intense relationship with their environment. Most of their homes didn't have central heating. They didn't have indoor bathrooms. And so every day they were exposed to, you know, heat, cold, all sorts of experiences that we don't necessarily have to have with the world around us. But also they played outdoors, of course. The homes they lived in were often very small, and mothers who were strapped for space sent the kids outside. And they went outside without supervision. Most of the time, they supervised themselves. They had a very intense relationship with the places in which they lived.
And how has that changed? When did that change?
It changes in different places at different times. I think farm children often had at least some of that experience throughout a good bit of the 20th century, simply because they lived out in the country and, you know, moms still sent their kids out to play. What changes is access to technology. Passive entertainment becomes much more popular as the 20th century goes by. Radio, the movies, and eventually by the middle of the 20th century, the television, give children a lot more opportunities to entertain themselves indoors. That's one of the things that happens. Housing in America changes too. If you had told children 100 years ago that they had to do all of their playing indoors, most of them would have been extremely unhappy because most families had very little space in their houses. But it's in the 1970s, the 1980s, 1990s that American homes become significantly larger, with spaces dedicated specifically to children's play, which makes it feasible for children to stay inside. And then there's also a real development of fear on the part of parents. Basically, from the late 1970s onward, parental fear of who could be lurking outside and who might be endangering their children, that causes parents to encourage their children to stay indoors.
Where did that fear come from? Is it real or imagined?
For most families, especially those living in middle-class neighborhoods, a lot of it's imagined. The actual incidence of something like stranger abduction and murder of children is no higher than it was when I was a child in the 1960s and 70s. What's happened is that we now know a whole lot more about it. In the late 1970s, you have the beginning of the milk carton campaigns, where the pictures of missing children are put on milk cartons, and they sit right there on the cabinet, and they stare at you while you eat your breakfast. You also have a real sensationalist media that makes sure that people in all parts of the country know about these really extreme cases. There are a few cases in the late 1970s, early 1980s that people are particularly familiar with. The Eitan Patz case in New York City is one. It's the one of the first milk carton children. And then even in Des Moines, where two paper boys were abducted, everybody knew about that. Everybody, of course, felt terrible for the families involved. And that kind of media attention on extreme cases, I think, has challenged parents' ability to think completely rationally about all of this.
What made you want to study this topic of the history of childhood, how childhood has changed?
Well, the shorter answer is that somebody asked me to write a small piece about this, and I realized that there wasn't any larger book tying all of this information together. The longer answer is the place where I grew up. I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s across the street from something that was called the High Line Canal in Denver. And it's an old irrigation ditch that connects the Platte to farmland farther to the east. And that was my childhood playground. It was a place where my friends and I, my brother and I, roamed very freely with almost no supervision. It was basically this long extended backyard. It was a trail and a canal that went on for 70 miles through Denver. And just having that experience of freedom, even within a city, in what was basically an urban wild space, really piqued my interest in how children play today. Because I can think back on the very free experience I had and then, you know, walk along the Skunk River here in Ames. And I've lived here for 13 years now. And in 13 years of walking along the Skunk, I've seen precisely one unaccompanied child playing out there. Whereas if this was the 60s or the 70s, there would have been a lot of kids down there messing around without parents being particularly concerned. And so that enormous disparity is something that's really interested me.
What's the difference between unsupervised play and supervised outings in your mind?
I think probably the biggest issue that stands out to me is the use of imagination and initiative on the part of the child. These supervised outings with mom and dad right there basically run according to the adult script. Basically, the parents decide where they're going, they decide what activities there will be, and that's what they do. Whereas when I was a kid wandering across the street to play in the canal, I could do anything. And so one day it might be pioneers going west, the next day it might be throwing rocks at trees. It all depended on what was going on in my imagination that day. And there's a lot less of that when the parent writes the script. And it's really hard for parents to step back and let the child lead in that situation and let the child have their own agenda. I think what's happened over the last 20, 30 years is that parents have begun to feel a very urgent need to supervise at a level that didn't exist. And in fact, there have been various studies with parents, particularly mothers, about why they think their children aren't getting enough time outside. And the mother's responses usually are, well, I don't have enough time to be out there with them. Instead of what my mother did, which was tell us to go outside and not come back in till dinner time. Nobody does that anymore. At least nobody I know of does that. There's a woman in New York City who's leading what she calls a free-range kids movement. She's been called the worst mother in America because she allowed her son to take the subway home all by himself, and he was 9 years old. And she saw absolutely nothing wrong with doing this, but all sorts of other parents interpreted this as being a terribly wrong thing to do. And she researched it. There was, in fact, nothing legally wrong with her allowing her child to take the subway home by himself, but all of these other parents, and I think a lot of this is peer pressure by parents, other parents interpreting this as negligent, whereas she interpreted it as being what was necessary for him to develop as an independent being.
Do you ever go back to the Denver? What's become of that canal?
That's very interesting. The High Line Canal is still there. It still runs 70 miles throughout Denver. It's still across from the house where my parents used to live. I've walked there a few times since growing up. But what's interesting is that it is no longer a place for children to play. You know, that late 1970s, early 1980s fear meant that the kids no longer go over there to play by themselves. And it's become an adult space. It's where grown-ups go to walk or to ride a bike. It's where they go to exercise for their health. It's very occasionally someplace where an adult drags a reluctant child to take a walk to try and get them interested. But it's not a place for children. And in 2000, the Denver Water Board, which controls the canal, had a series of public hearings about, you know, now that the canal was not used so much for irrigation, what should happen to it. And there was an outpouring of support for keeping that as a kind of public space. But 99% of the discussion was about adults and their needs. There were a few grandparents who said, this is a great place for me to go walking with my grandchildren. Or a mother who said, this is a great place for a child to learn how to ride a bike without being threatened by an automobile. But almost all of the discussion was about grown-ups and needing a place to exercise for health and needing a place where they can wind down after a busy day. You know, the kids weren't even in the discussion, which I found really sad and revealing because 30, 40 years ago, it was all about the kids.
That's so interesting because we would probably think that we have more of a kid-centered culture now because we devote so much attention to their safety and their entertainment and their comfort compared to the past where it's just like kick the kids out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the kids' real interests have been subverted.
Well, it's really difficult to find outdoor public space where children are able to use it in any sort of interesting, creative way. Instead, if you go to the park and you look at what's going on there, you have, you know, the kids playing soccer. You have the playground, which is neatly outlined in timbers with a nice soft space in the middle where the kids are allowed to play. And you have all those parents watching them, making sure they stay in that area playing. And, you know, you look a few feet to the left and a few feet to the right, and there are no kids just independently deciding what to do out there. Instead, everybody's either on the swings, or they're on the slide, or they're on, you know, the play structure. Now, I'm always heartened a little bit when I see them doing things they're not supposed to be doing. You'll notice a number of our parks here in Ames have signs up about how to properly use the equipment. And it says, you know, don't walk up the slide, don't jump off the swings, don't climb up the outside of the play structure. And it always gives me a little bit of happiness to see the kids climbing up the slide, climbing down the outside of it, jumping off the swings. You don't see a whole lot of that, but you do see some, and that makes me very happy. I think about all the playground play I had as a kid, and so much of it was, again, unscripted. A lot of it was kind of dangerous, but it also was really fun. And if you really carefully script exactly how kids are supposed to use all of this stuff, which of course is done for the purpose of liability, then you take a lot of the fun out of it. You know, why would they want to go outside and play when there's so many restrictions on it that it's not fun anymore?
Yeah, if somebody has told you that playing means going up the stairs and down the mm-hmm. slide, up the stairs, you know, over and over.
Who wants to do that?
Yeah.
That's boring.
I had never thought of that.
That is so incredibly boring. And, of course, it's exactly what the Consumer Product Safety Commission wants them to do and, you know, issues little bulletins about them doing. But it's boring.
What is the solution?
I mean, I don't know. I would love to see more kids out playing independently, but part of the problem with that is that there are so few kids out there playing independently that there's not enough, you know, bossy little girls to tattle on people who are being really dangerous. I mean, part of what we relied on as kids was that there were enough other kids around that if something really dangerous was happening, that parents often got told. There are also often a lot of parents around during the day, and so there were always extra eyes, and if someone was really misbehaving, they might get told off, you know, 5 times before they got home to their own mother. So, you know, I would love to see more kids outside, more creative play, but it really involves convincing parents to let go. And, you know, maybe letting go to the extent that you send the kid with a cell, you teach. And this is something that an author named Richard Louv, who wrote Last Child in the Woods, talks about. Providing the kid the cell phone and providing them the knowledge to know when there's a problem and when they need to get adult help. That to me seems like a sensible sort of solution in a lot of families. But also a lot of those kids need convincing to go outside now. It's not just that adults are very, very carefully keeping control of children. It's that a lot of children have lost the desire to go outside. Or they may go out once and then after having gone out once decide that they've seen all there is to see and they don't want to go out again. And, you know, part of it is educating children to really see what's around them, to enjoy what's around them, to, you know, leave behind all the gadgets so that they can really enjoy being where they are and value that. But it's difficult. I mean, there's so many different layers to this problem.
Yeah.
That it's hard to know, you know, where to begin peeling back the layers.
Yeah. I also heard you talking about community, like the need for there to be kids from other households joining
right.
them, and, you know.
That's what makes it fun.
Right.
Not all of my outdoor adventures, but most of my outdoor adventures happened in the presence of friends. And, you know, there were the kids down the block, there was my brother, there was my best friend who lived 5 blocks away. It was as if all the children from I don't know how many blocks around converged on the canal to play. And, you know, converged on summer nights on the streets and underneath the streetlights. And there was a whole community of kids out there playing. It wasn't just me by myself, which would have, who knows, potentially been dangerous. It was the whole neighborhood. And the parents were all outside talking to each other. You know, one of the things that I've noticed time and again and that other people have mentioned is that the sound of summer evenings now is very, very different. 40 years ago, what you would have heard on a summer evening is a bunch of kids outside making noise and parents yelling at them that it's time to come in for bed and things like that. These days, you go out on a summer evening and what you hear are air conditioners cycling off and on. You don't hear people out playing anymore. Which to me is really kind of sad.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. Today we are talking about kids and the benefits of outdoor play. Our last guest was Pamela Riney Kerberg from the History Department at ISU. Next up, I talk to Rebecca Christoffel, who splits her time as a wildlife specialist and an instructor at ISU, teaching students how to be naturalists and especially how to interpret nature for kids. So, Rebecca, could you tell us what you're trying to teach children? What is the curriculum or agenda for a naturalist?
Well, when I'm trying to teach my students how to be naturalists, what I'm really trying to help them do is to engage children of all ages in either discovering or maintaining their sense of wonder with other living things. And their sense of stewardship or kinship with other living plants and animals. And so my agenda is not so much for anybody to do any one particular thing, but to help people understand what a wonderful world we get to live in.
And how do you go about doing that? How do you build that kinship?
Well, with small children, it's fairly easy. You get them out of doors, and the least little thing fascinates small children, whether it's a bug on the sidewalk, whether it's just rocks that they can throw into the pond. It's that unstructured discovery that is so important. And as an adult, if you can encourage that and nurture that sense of curiosity and that love for other things around you, that can only grow stronger as that child grows older.
What about the kid sitting in front of a screen? Nature is not comfortable, not as comfortable as the living room. How do you engage a kid like that?
Well, that's a little more difficult. But what I've found is that if you are an adult and you'll give a child some undivided love and attention and say, hey, let's go out for a walk together and see what we find, and guide them through, help them see that they are safe, that it's not as yucky as they think that it is. Go and show them things that you have already found out there. For instance, right now, it's mid-May. What could be better than going outside? My husband just went for a walk yesterday in Brookside Park. 45 species of birds on that little walk. Now, I don't think that you have to have small children identifying all the birds, but I bet if you got them to close their eyes for just one full minute and list all of the different kinds of bird sounds they heard, they themselves would just be utterly amazed and want to find out more.
Some parents and teachers might be afraid, though, that going out of doors, encountering things might raise questions in kids. They'd say, what's that? And they wouldn't have the answer. And that makes grown-ups uncomfortable, especially if they're teachers and parents, people in authority. What do you recommend in that situation?
Well, first of all, I say, get over it. I'm the state wildlife extension specialist, and I don't have all the answers. I get lots of phone calls and emails, and sometimes I have to say, I don't know. I'll see what I can find out for you, and I'll get back to you. One of the things that I suggest to teachers is to say, gee, you know, that's a really good question. How would we go about finding the answer together? And that way, you are letting the child or the student know that even you don't know everything, but that you do know how to go about finding out the answers to your questions, and that you want to help them learn how to find out the answers to their questions. And I think that's really powerful. I think that's good not only for the teacher, but also good for the student to know that no matter who you are, you don't have all of the answers.
Is there anything else you'd like to add on the topic of getting kids outdoors, getting them to play outdoors, and really experiencing that kinship with nature?
I once was asked what was my greatest gift. And I said, my greatest gift was my imagination. And I was very fortunate in that I had parents who really helped us develop our imaginations. We didn't have a lot of toys. We had to go outside and spend time outdoors a lot, make pictures out of clouds. And it is that imagination that helps me to solve problems. And that is really nurtured when you go outside and you engage other living things, because there are so many questions that you have about them. How does that animal fly? Can we imagine how that might be possible? And then go about trying to investigate the answer. And I have to think that the more that kids get outside and are familiar with these plants and animals, the more that they are going to really develop a kinship with them, and they're not going to want to see them disappear. For me, you know, people talk about church, and I can think of no more spiritual place for me than being out in prairie. I feel incredibly small and insignificant when I'm in prairie, and that is a wonderful feeling to have. And yet, because I have this sense of kinship, I feel very much a part of the prairie. It's also really, really beneficial in terms of relaxation. Walking in nature is incredibly relaxing to me. I'm also walking. That is incredibly good for me from a physical standpoint. So physically, emotionally, and spiritually, this kinship, this wanting to be out with other plants and animals, benefits me in so many different ways. And I can only imagine, I only know, there's lots of empirical research out there that demonstrates that it does the same thing for others. You know, there's this wonderful, wonderful ecologist, E.O. Wilson, who talks about something called the biophilia hypothesis. You know, that we as humans are inherently drawn to other living things. And I very much believe that is true. Sometimes we lose sight of it, but for most of us, at least as small children, it's incredible the draw that other living things have for us.
Well, thanks, Rebecca. It sounds like you spend much of your energy trying to share that passion with other people.
Thank you. That's very true. I just hope that I can reach one or two.
That was Rebecca Christoffel of ISU and ISU Extension, and this is Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder, caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful, when the sky was full of thunder, and tearful at the falling of a star. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the pains of ponies go up and down. We're captive on a carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came and go.
And this is Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. We are talking about how to nurture a child's connection to nature and prevent nature deficit disorder. One preschool in Ames makes this a central part of its instruction. I was lucky enough to visit Prairie Flower Children's Center on a beautiful spring day and found the kids playing outside as they waited for their parents to come pick them up.
Do you record voices on that much?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Well, why do you do that?
Because people in Ames probably would just love to hear kids talking about what they like to do when they play. What do you like to do when you play?
Play in the sandbox.
Sandbox is your favorite?
I mean tire swing.
And the tire swing.
Go somewhere and build a dam. Like, go to somewhere, build a dam with rocks, and then also walking in water.
They go round and round, and the things of ponies go up and down.
Introduce yourself and explain, if you could, why you have brought your child here to Prairie Flower Preschool.
My name is Amy Moore, and our daughter, Calla, attends here. This is our first year here in Ames, and we were looking at preschools and their availability here before we moved, And I just kind of happened on Prairie Flower, and I really liked the fact that they emphasized a lot of outdoor time and that it was more of kind of a free-flowing program as opposed to a more structured preschool. And I think our daughter has really enjoyed it, and really her confidence has improved a lot from a lot of the work they do and going down the scary stairs down into the woods and stuff. And we've seen her come out of her shell a lot with that. So I think it's been a good experience for her.
That's neat. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Did you have anything to add?
My name is Stacia Thomas. Our son Liam seems to be doing great things here. They really promote learning through other children as opposed to guided by teachers, which is really interesting to watch him blossom that way. Yeah, he's just really done well here.
Thanks.
It's a joy to see the children in what I believe is such a healthy environment.
Right. Nature. Now they're swinging on a tree swing.
Yeah. Yep.
And there are five of them together right now.
Yeah. Yeah, they're having fun. They're always smiling, and I can feel that they've had a good full day, a healthy day, being outside and walking and being in the woods.
We can only look behind from where we came and go round and round and round in a circle.
Prairie Flower is based on the Waldorf philosophy of education, named after the factory where children were first instructed using this method. In fact, Waldorf schools are based on the observations of Rudolf Steiner. Here is Lauren Struckmeyer, who graduated in 2011 with a degree in early child education from Rudolf Steiner College and came to Ames to be a co-teacher at Prairie Flower.
We acknowledge there are phases of childhood and phases of life that can be grouped into 7-year segments. And development and consciousness of the individual shifts between these 7-year cycles. From birth to 7, you are a very imitative being. You are guided by your will forces and movement and doing. And it's all about experiencing the world as a place of goodness. We want them to know that the world is good. And then from 7 to 14, after the change of teeth, you are experiencing that the world is beautiful. And so the teacher is an artist. And then from 14 on through high school is about discovering truth. What is my personal truth? What do I find to be truthful? And the teacher is noted as being the scientist. And that's when you get much more into the abstract concepts and critical thinking. It's a different realm of thinking. The brain has reached a different stage of development.
I asked Delphine Douglas, longtime Prairie Flower teacher, how nature fits into the Waldorf philosophy.
Going back to the neurological development and how children learn through movement and learn through sensory integration, then their whole body is involved with the activities and being in nature that's much more complex and interesting and open for much more imagination than most playthings that they are offered nowadays, which are more formed. When we're out in the woods, there aren't any toys, quote unquote, but everything is their plaything. Everything is for them to explore and bring their imaginations into. And so a stick can be used for digging. A stick can be used to break, and it's part of a sailboat. The stick can be used for making roads and laying all of them together and making roads or what have you. So they don't need anything down there except warm clothing and their own imaginations and being surrounded by our gesture of control and walls and safety. So when we're out in the woods and I see how the children traverse and use their bodies, to me that is all academic readiness. Because all their neurological systems are getting healthfully integrated into a whole being that can, you just get out of their way because they're going to be ready to take on the world. Prairie Flower is a sanctuary for childhood. It's not about adults' agendas. It's not about legislative or corporate agendas. It's about what does the child need at this stage in their life, this stage in their development. And the three-year-old is going to need different things than the five-year-old, but they're going to find it within the same environment. They're going to play with things in a different way.
Yeah. And to support the neurological development that Delphine was just speaking of, we have a parent evening next Monday night. And so we've both been reading up on this just to give our parents some research, because adults love factual, evidence-based research. And I was reading an article that was speaking to the optimal zone of arousal, which is a state in the brain where it has neither too much anxiety nor too little. And this is the only physiological state where learning and adaptive behavior take place. And nature promotes this optimal zone of arousal. It has been proven by neurological scientists, nature has, to improve the immune system, reduce anger, improve your mood, reduce stress, among many other things. And it is so detrimental to not experience nature that they have a new title for that. It's nature deficit disorder. Okay. And Richard Louv has a book, The Last Child in the Woods, that speaks to that. So it's all very interesting. And as Delphine said, the children love being in nature, and all children love being in nature. Children belong in nature. And so it is a real travesty when they're taken out of that environment that they are so innately drawn to and belong in.
Yeah. And we take them out of that environment so early in their lives. They go into systems or places where they have a very controlled life that's within a, you know, a building or a playground with maybe a couple of swings, but they're not able to really engage themselves into the breadth of what a natural setting can offer. And children need movement. We cannot take movement away from children and expect any academic performance.
If I would paraphrase what you said a moment ago, it sounded like you were saying, we don't need to teach the children how to play.
Mm-hmm. There's seldomly, every now and then, a child has come who has been so hardened by some of culture's influences and some of the effects of what has gone before that they have sort of forgotten how to play. And if they have spent a lot of time with screen time and they haven't been active with their bodies, if they're chronically not getting enough sleep nor good nutrition, or even a hint from parents saying, you know, it's just play, it's not important. Parents talking to children very, very academically when they're very, very young, then they have trouble entering into play. And it'll take a little time for some of those children to watch the other children and get back to that archetypal basic, oh yes, I can imagine and play and have this kind of interaction with the other children and with my own imaginations. But most children come here, they're just ready to, they're on it. They know what to do.
Up and down, we're captive on a carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came and go.
The day is longer than most preschools. goes from 9 to 12, 15, because I want to make sure the children have plenty of outside playtime and plenty of indoor playtime, and with enough time to gently move through the transitions from less structure to much structure. So the rhythm of the day is that they come, we can be assured that they're very well dressed because we're outside. When they come, we can see how they're dressed. Then we gather to usually go down into the woods. Sometimes we stay on top, particularly more in the beginning of the year when the children are new and we're all getting established in our relationships. But throughout a lot of the year, we go down into the woods, down into the ravines and in the little streams and along the bank of the river. And then we play. We have an area that the children made down there, which is our storytelling area. They found a big tree that had fallen over, and so we got the vertical branches and different things. We created this kind of enclosure. Then they rolled the logs as a circular little amphitheater, and that's what we sit on. And the tradition in Waldorf education is to orally tell the story. So we tell the story down there. Then we come back up the hill. We have very, very strong children after a while. And when we come inside, we have a very structured circle time, which brings forth a lot of elements of the season. So, for example, now in the spring, well, we have these springtime images of how the animals and the birds are responding to spring. Well, if it's springtime, it must be cleaning time. And so the circle time is us getting involved in an imaginative time of how we're cleaning our home and washing the windows and the floor and dusting the shelves and raking the garden, getting the leaves out, ready to grow, washing the dog, he smells, you know, all these things. And it's through song and poetry, with gestures and movement throughout the whole time, either gross movement or fine finger movement. And the children, given that they're such imaginative beings, can enter in to the meaning and be imbued with the beauty of the language or the song. So these children go home singing songs a lot. Even our transitions are by singing. They hear a certain song and they know, okay, that's the transition for something else. After circle time, different activities will happen depending on the day. On Mondays, they wash their hands and we gather at our snack table where they need their bread. I start the bread beforehand and then they knead the dough, and they've ground the spelt berries in the wooden grinder. So they've had that motor activity that will eat the next day. On Tuesday after circle time, they come in for a painting experience. It's called the wet on wet method. The paper is wet. Watercolor paints are, of course, wet. So it's wet on wet. You can't control the content as much. It's more about what is the experience, the deep emotional experience of the color red or yellow? And then when the two are brought together, what does that result in? So, of course, now we're working with blues and yellows. On another day, they'll be chopping their vegetables for stone soup made with barley. And after they've done an activity, they come back into the center of the room for imaginative indoor playtime. And during that playtime, they can choose the objects of things to play with and how to play with them. There's the more vigorous activities. There's the quieter activities of maybe sewing or working with some geometric designs and creating things. Then we clean up. We have another little finger story. We wash hands. They sit down for a snack, family style. Nobody gets to eat. Nobody is given their fork or their spoon until everybody is served. We don't want to leave anybody out. Make sure everybody is served before we start. After snack, they wash their own dishes, and then that's about the end of the day. And we get dressed in our warm clothes, maybe have a little more time to go outside. The rhythm of the day is based with a lot of conscious forethought on our part as to what is an out-breath experience for the children and what is an in-breath, out-breath, in-breath. So that has a rhythmic structure to it, just like the seasons have. Well, spring, what is that? Mm-hmm. Our huge out-breath out of the in-breath of winter time.
And I notice a lot of things in this environment are soft. There's drapery over the lights. Mm-hmm. A lot of things are natural, made mm-hmm. out of natural materials. There's fur, skins. All of this seems very intentional.
Yes.
Well, Delphine just mentioned that nature mm-hmm. leaves so much to the imagination because nothing is plastic and formed already for the child. And so we mirror that in the classroom environment as well. Most of the toys in here are, as we call them, unformed. They have millions of possibilities for the child to imagine, to manipulate with. And even the dolls and the babies that we have sometimes will just have eyes or a blank face because the child does have that innate capacity to imagine what this baby's face is this very moment. Is it a crying baby? Is it a happy baby? Is it a hungry baby? And so we have lots of things that are open to the imagination. We have things that are made from nature because Steiner believed, much like our philosophy of playing outside, that whatever this young human being is touching, it should be from nature. It shouldn't all be plastic because we come from nature. We are a part of that kingdom of nature. So the materials we use are made of beeswax. We have beeswax crayons. Mm-hmm. We have beautiful watercolor paints. A lot of things are from a European culture because Waldorf education was birthed out of Germany. We use the sheepskin rugs for the tactile experience because, also as Delphine mentioned, they are sense beings. They learn through their senses, especially the tactile sense, hence the wood, but the sheepskins too. Everything that they experience should be nourishing to these senses so that they have a healthy integration of their senses. And the lights, Delphine put so much care and thought into the lights being warm and not a cold, hard fluorescent light, but something that mirrors what's out in nature, something that nourishes the whole human being. And warm lights with a softness around them. It just feels good. It feels good to adults. People come into this environment and they don't want to leave. And you'll hear that from almost any Waldorf preschool and kindergarten classroom. The colors are inviting. They're soft. They're not garish and harsh. There aren't posters everywhere. And not to say that that's wrong or bad, it's just this philosophy looks at nourishing the senses in a different way. And we use a lot of plant and animal materials, like wool roving to make our puppets, the children finger knit with 100% wool yarn. And so it is a very quality education because these are quality materials we're using. And we make things that are practical and useful. And so it's not that we're using 100% wool yarn and then making something and throwing it away. We make something that's practical and useful, something that might hold a bag that they've sewn. So we also have this experience of really cherishing something that you have made that has taken you a long time to make, maybe a few weeks they've been sewing something and using these beautiful quality materials, and then you keep it for years after preschool. And I think that is something that our society is very out of balance with right now. And so we hope to instill that within children, that not everything is throwaway, and that you can make a lot of things. And we fix our toys when they break in Prairie Flower, because we do sometimes forget our gentle hands and things break. And that's another reason why we like to use quality materials, so that they don't break, because we all know how much plastic toys can just break. And it's hard to fix that.
Even the first aid kit at Prairie Flower Preschool is based on natural remedies, and the protocol for its use refers back to the Steiner philosophy about what the child's true nature is at this stage in their life.
Tell me about the healing basket.
Oh, the healing basket. There's two of them, one inside and one outside. And the healing basket is this beautiful basket that with a silk lining. And within the basket is a beautiful little pillow embroidered and filled with lavender blossoms, so they can smell that relaxing fragrance. There's a little healing doll that's just the size for their hands that they can hold. Sometimes a child will be drawn to the coldness of a rock, and that's grounding for them, so that they can hold that while they're being administered with, what does it need? Is it a scratch? Does it need washing? And then placing a calendula salve that we made from calendula blossoms, that which are quite antiseptic. Or is it more of a bruise, in which case we'll go to the homeopathic arnica. And so then, of course, you have Band-Aids. And the children are so aware. There's such a group consciousness of the healing basket, that something might happen and a child will just go and they'll bring it to the scene. You know, or often I like to have the perpetrator go get the healing basket, because it's not so much a matter of blame. It's a matter of fixing it. Something happened. Now let's fix it. Let's come to it with compassion.
And with action. Young children live in their will forces and movement.
And go round and round and round in the circle game.
Lauren Struckmeyer has the last word in this interview.
I guess one thing also that comes to mind when I think of Waldorf education is that it's really very therapeutic for every child. It's a very healing education for every child, whether they have a learning or behavioral need or not. It's healing. And it really, I think, its ultimate goal is to steward peace. I think that is really the highest endeavor, is to create peaceful human beings that will go forth in the world. And that's what we need.
You have been listening to KHOY Community Radio. Our guests today were Pamela Riney Kerberg of the ISU History Department, Rebecca Christoffel, a naturalist with ISU and ISU Extension, and Delphine Douglas and Lauren Struckmeyer of Prairie Flower Children's Center. Contact information is listed on the KHOY website. Go to khoyfm.org and find the Shows tab. The name of the show is Heart of Iowa. This show was engineered by Richard Morrison. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Our theme song is The Fisherman by Leo Kottke. Your participation as audience is what makes our work worthwhile. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.